This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all things depression with Rick Samada. He's a Guardian columnist and author whose book has just come out on the 8th of August called I Never Said I Loved You. It's a memoir of his life coming to terms with mental illness, learning to better understand the history of mental illness in the family, and is just generally a fascinating insight into the life of a creative person figuring out where they fit in the world and what their calling is. That all sounds quite serious. It is actually quite funny as well. It's very heartfelt. And as we mentioned a little bit in the interview, there's a level of honesty in it that I really admire and find so refreshing. So before we get into that interview, we've got a few stats just to set the scene for depression. So these are from the Mental Health Foundation. So the first one: depression is the predominant mental health problem worldwide, followed by anxiety, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder. I found this one interesting, but partly because I don't quite agree with it. So when I started out the podcast, I very much thought that depression was the most common mental illness, and in the way they've described it, that is true. But the more I've grown to understand anxiety disorders and the more stats we've looked at on those, if you look at types of disorder, anxiety is actually number one. But because there's different types, if you divide them down,
you break it down, yeah,
then it kind of changes things that can be quite confusing. So when they're referring to anxiety as the second most predominant worldwide, it's referring to generalized anxiety disorder.
Yeah. Whereas, OCD or, yeah, other things.
Whereas there's actually quite a few anxiety conditions. So I thought that was interesting because it's probably because of stats like that where it can be a little bit unclear, or you can interpret how common mental illnesses are in different ways, that maybe I came into starting the podcast thinking depression was the most common. And in a way, I think I felt quite comfortable with that I thought, I have the most common one. So it's the most normal of the non-neurotypical.
Yeah, so that's okay then.
Yeah, yeah, and in a way, I think I almost felt a bit miffed when I found out that anxiety conditions were more common. That I was like, oh,
I need one of those then.
Yeah, like, I don't know how I feel about it now that I'm like, well, not so much I needed one of those, but in a way, I think as a young person, when I was first diagnosed, I slightly rationalized it and didn't feel so bad about the diagnosis because I thought, oh, it's the most common.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm, on the other hand, have never been bothered about that in terms of whether it's common or not. It's just that it feels so shit that you just don't want it.
Mm.
You know, like it just feels like the worst thing in the world. Like, whereas, and like you, until you start talking to more people with mental illnesses from different backgrounds and people who suffer from extreme anxiety disorders, they live a living hell as well. Like, everything's so subjective.
Yeah, I guess I never equated commonality with like ease so much, but I think maybe looking back on it, it felt easier because I thought, well, it's common, so then maybe it's more understandable. Like, it felt easier
to accept.
To accept and feel that there was still a lot of understanding out there. A lot of people understand depression. A lot of people experience it. So I'd have that in common with many people. There's a lot of like articles written about it. And so in that way, it feels more kind of mainstream and understood.
Yeah.
Which on the surface of things may seem the case. But one of the reasons why we like to revisit common mental illnesses on the podcast is because misconceptions still persist. Yeah. Whether it's common or not. So yes, maybe most people have at least a vague understanding of depression, which they might not do about certain less common conditions. But that doesn't mean they get it. That doesn't mean they understand the severity of it.
Yeah.
People can understand it in a vague sense without actually understanding what it is like to live with. When you experience a condition like this, it can be incredibly isolating. and close yourself off, that can feel like the safe option. But that option also closes you off from realizing you're not alone in it.
Yeah, which is why podcasts are so good. So for any of our listeners out there who are living with depression and you are in and you're listening to this, then so we're here on a podcast and you can hear us talking about it and feel that, you know, you're not alone, because you're right, it is isolating. You can be physically become so isolated and emotionally, but physical isolations, you know, just snowballs.
Yeah, so in summary, if you're in bed right now, no judgment.
Yeah, no judgment.
So the final stat is that 4 to 10% of people in England experience depression in their lifetime. And even within that massive chunk of people, there'll be such variation in how severely they're feeling it. For many people, depression can be something that is a part of their life ongoing, but doesn't seem to outwardly affect their life. Certainly for myself, I've come across quite a bit of that, where people at times don't believe that I deal with depression because they see me on my good days. They see me when I'm high functioning, or they've met me since the worst periods of depression I've had have ended. And that doesn't in any way invalidate that it existed, and that it's still something I have to be mindful of, that I can go back to a certain place and I can feel that when those symptoms are kind of riling, and then that's the time for me to do self-care, or that's for me the time for me to examine stresses in my life and see, is there something that's contributing to this that could be changed?
And do you think there normally is?
I think generally there's something. It may not be the cause, but there's something that's
and it may not
stressful
be obvious, may it? You
that
know.
Could make it easier, even if that's not the thing causing it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, it might not be obvious sometimes. And like you said, sometimes it actually probably, there may be nothing.
Yeah, and that's okay too. Sometimes the answer is not to change anything, is just to have a day off.
Yeah.
I'm not always the best at doing that. And that's okay. There doesn't always have to be a reason. Sometimes you just need time off. And that's the thing. And I'm not always the best at acknowledging or acting on that. But there are times I have to. There are times I'm just stopped in my tracks by how I'm feeling. And I realise that if I try working through it, I'm just going to be unproductive and then feel worse.
Yeah.
So I'm better to just take some time or have a nap.
Do you know anybody who you feel has a good, you know, can really empathise with you or with anybody who's living with depression who hasn't experienced it themselves? Do you think it's a thing? I can't actually imagine being able to, you know, be empathetic and not know what it feels like.
I think you can be. We talk about it a little bit in the episode with Rick, whether in fact it's a challenge if you've never experienced mental illness or mental illness symptoms. How do you relate to what they're going through? And I think you definitely can, but it is a challenge. Mm. And maybe that's part of the people equating it with being a feeling at times and not an illness. The symptoms can vary so much. It's not feeling a bit depressed, but worse. There's a whole set of symptoms. Mm. And that's worth acknowledging, as is the fact that that varies for people. But I think there's always going to be areas of your own experience you can draw on to empathise with people, even if that doesn't relate to mental illness.
Mm.
Like if you've experienced grief, that can have a similar feeling of weighing you down and not wanting to socialise and just wanting to stay and sit in the feelings, which is very much what depression feels like for me. And that's what grief's felt like to me. So I can kind of see the parallel there.
Yeah, that's a good...
They're not the same, but if you've felt something similar, then I think generally you can at least get an idea. But equally, you don't have to get it. You know, if people are listening to this in the hope of getting to understand what someone close to them is going through, you don't have to understand it perfectly. But if you have at least some understanding and relate it back to some of the experiences you may have that could be similar, then
that can be helpful.
That can be something. And generally the person with a friendly listening ear will happily share what they're experiencing and help you understand.
Mm.
You never have to have all the answers to be a good listener.
Just don't say, pull yourself together.
Yeah.
Get over it.
Yeah, that is not good listening. So we'll get into this episode with Rick in a minute. One quick disclaimer, if you do hear background noise, we did record this in Edinburgh whilst he was performing at the Edinburgh Literary Festival. So there may be some background noise there. We'll do our best in the edit. But no, overall, it's a really brilliant interview. I'm so delighted to have met him. I think you'll tell from listening to it that we got on well. And hopefully, if you like it, we'll get him on again. We'll see. One other thing I'll just mention before I forget. Rick does have an audiobook of the book he'll mention at the end of the episode. And so if you do want to give that a try, our Audible referral link is still live. So go to bit.ly/mentalbooks and you can try your first book with Audible for free if you want to try the audiobook. And we'll get into the episode with Rick in just a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Rick Samata. My first initiation into mental health problems were probably, I was very young. I remember being aware of death from a very young age. I think probably around, it's difficult to say, but somewhere between 4 and 6, being aware of death and being consumed by this feeling of blackness and what it would be like to die. And I couldn't breathe, and I'd start to get what I now realize were panic attacks, you know, from really early childhood. And it was just an obsessive thought that kept repeating itself. And every time I went to bed, I'd think about death and how I didn't want to die. And I remember going to my parents' door and knocking on the door in the middle of the night and saying, you know, I don't want to die, I don't want to die. And break me down in tears. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of a difficult thing, conversation to have with your child. I can't really remember what they said or what you can say, really, because, I mean, it is a fact. And I still do think about it, although I guess you sort of inch towards an acceptance of death. But so there have been lots of other instances in my life of things that have triggered depressions, and whether it was racism when I was a child and a teenager, or the kind of self-loathing you get as a teenager, I think, which a lot of people have. Or
do you mind sharing a bit of those experiences?
So, I mean, when I was young, I remember racism was a real problem, and I remember there was National Front graffiti over every train I'd get on, or people would draw on their pencil cases. It's quite a sort of standard, mm-hmm. you know, kid thing to do. Yeah, sort of white supremacists were fairly accepted mainstream sort of thing, as they are again. So, you know, bashing comes back around. But that had a really catastrophic effect on my own internal sense of self, because you internalise that sense of I'm worthless, I'm hated, I'm despised, I don't belong here.
Right, because if everyone around you is giving you the same message, it takes so much strength to constantly think the opposite.
Yes.
Particularly as a young child,
more,
it's natural.
More strength than a child has, yeah. Or should have to have. Yeah, absolutely. I think when you're old, I was talking to someone who was saying that their child is currently struggling to fit in at school because she doesn't feel like she's from the same background as people. And I remember thinking it's so hard when you're young, because all those things that are good about you and are special make you different. You don't see them as strengths. You're ashamed of them and you just want to cover them up.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't have the strength of the internal resources. And as you get older, I think that's why it's good to stay alive and get older, because you learn to draw on your own resources and you get stronger, and you learn that to trust yourself and believe in yourself more and to be stronger. But yeah, in those early years, you're really so at the mercy of other people and what other people think. You're so sensitive. Yeah, it's kind of annihilating.
Yeah, and so you'd experienced symptoms from a very young age, and naturally your parents didn't always know how to support you in that. You know, what do you say to a 4-year-old that's scared of death and also is experiencing panic attacks, which, if you don't know what that is, it can feel like death. It can feel like a heart attack. It can feel like your body's shutting down.
Yeah, it felt like dying. I thought, I'm killing myself. My body's killing me. My heart's going too fast and I can't breathe, so I feel like I'm suffocating. This is how death will feel every time. And it was incredibly overwhelmingly, paralyzingly, existentially terrifying every time. It's just that raw fear, just the most animal sensation. I'm going to die now. I'm dying now. And there's not much you can say to someone in that particular moment that's going to come. You can just sort of be there and be a soothing presence and a physical presence and keep talking, and hopefully that, you know, over a few minutes or so that will start to have an effect. But yeah, it's kind of, you don't know what's happening, they don't know what's happening either. I didn't know what a panic attack was.
Yeah, so. One of the things that a previous guest said off air, which I thought was really powerful, was that a real breakthrough for him with his panic attacks was when he realised you can't stay at that level. No matter what, no matter how bad it is, you can't sustain this level of panic, so they'll always end. And he said that really kind of clicked a switch for him.
Well, it's like that thing where you've cried all your tears. And like you've got to the end of this, you sort of long bout of just can't stop, just retching up these tears. But then it gets to a certain point where that breath comes in, you're like, that's all out now. I can't maintain that. So my body's found a way to calm itself again. And it doesn't mean you're less affected, or, you know, the situation is better in some way, but it just means you've had your kind of your allotted trauma, or physical trauma, I guess.
Yeah,
for that point, yeah.
And so when did you start to get more clarity over what you were experiencing?
Not for decades, really. I mean, I was aware when I was young. I thought what I was going through was just teenage angst.
Right.
And I thought everyone has it. Everyone wants to die. Everyone hates themselves to the point of wanting to self-harm. They can't stand to be in their own skin, in their own body. And I thought that's just a universal thing. You shouldn't make a fuss, but you're not special in any way. And it'll pass. I fervently hope this would. Maybe as soon as my 20th birthday, as soon as I no longer have a teen in my age, I'll suddenly grow out of this.
Right.
And it was sort of, I guess, yeah, the first few years of my 20s at university, when I started to realise, no, I still have these same terrors and these same feelings about myself. Difficult brain that is sort of rebelling against itself, and it's not got better. If anything, it's got worse.
And so was it similar symptoms that had sustained, or did it kind of change as you grew older?
It sort of mutates, because when you're young, you're learning to new experiences, I guess it attaches to different things. So you're moving out, or you're discovering sex. In my case, it wasn't really much in teenage years, but a little bit later. Yeah, and you're discovering people that are from the same geographical place as you and learning more about the world. So it feels like it mutates and attaches to different things. And then later on, when you go into the world of work, that can be a really difficult thing to navigate in your 20s, and you have no power, and you're lost, and you haven't really grown into your own skills yet, and you have all this ambition, and when things aren't moving forwards in the way you want, which is sort of my experience of my entire 20s, that's really difficult, I think. Yeah, career and work stuff. And I was an actor, so an industry which is built on rejection. We think of actors and we think of like the tip of the iceberg. It's like 1% of people who do really well and get a lot of jobs and choose what they want to do. Below that, there's just all the people who are working in your cafes or doing data entry at the council. All the people that are trying to pursue this dream, and it's not happening. Obviously, that's happening across the arts in lots of different spheres. And just that frustration of not, a feeling like you've got all this stuff inside and you're not able to make use of it. And it's just wasted, and what are you for?
Yeah, I love that question of what are you for? Because that seems to be one of the big lies in our society, that you're meant to go to university and know what you want to study and have a whole plan for what happens for the rest of your life. And I don't meet many people like that.
I have, and they're the most boring people I've ever met. People just know like what they're going to be doing, and they always earn more than their age, and they know what they're going to be doing in 10 years and what time they're going to, what job they're going to have, you know, what position they're going to be in. Their whole life is sort of laid out, and actually I start to see it as a sort of prison, and a lot of it's built on expectations that their parents had for them, or they just feel because of their class maybe that they there are some things that they do that they have to do, and they don't have any freedom in their life, even though they might have a lot of money and, you know, social networks, but it's its own kind of prison. I think
it's an odd thing, isn't it, that for some people that's very reassuring. For my parents, they're both in the NHS, and so for the most part they've had one employer for their whole life, and that's something that I've struggled to imagine, and to me sounds very restrictive. But yeah, to them, they see all the opportunities of how broad their fields are.
It's strange. That's a generational shift, I think, isn't it? That relationship to work. And
I think it's also partly context of us being an Irish family that moved over. And so there's that, at times, divide that they felt the need to get a certain job with a title. And I've grown up not with that same need.
Yeah. What relationship to work do you want to have?
I always wanted to be self-employed, actually, from when I was very little. And I didn't really know what that,
did you know what that was.
No, I had...
Just wanted to do a self-assessment.
I was one of those kids that you'd ask, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I had a list, and I was told a lot that you're not allowed a list. You've got to choose one.
Have a list. Now you've got to have a list, right?
Yeah. Well, that's... Particularly if you're doing anything creative. Yeah. That's the way.
I think that's good, you know, I guess... Yeah, I absolutely... I agree that whole model of a job for life sounds like absolute prison cell to me. I want to be able to express different parts of myself and explore different areas. And I love learning new skills and entering new areas, like whether it's acting and then journalism and then books, you know, who knows what comes next. I love that challenging, that feeling of it's a sort of adventure. I guess that's quite high stakes, and then when it's not working, you can feel very sort of beaten down. You don't have the security of that job for life thing. But no, I love being self-employed. I love knowing that if I need to go to the park and just walk around for an hour and then come back and do my work, I can do that. I don't have to ask anyone's permission. I can live my life.
Yeah, that's the kind of prioritising your well-being and your happiness that for a lot of people it takes living with mental illness to learn the importance of.
Absolutely, yeah. I've realised that that's very important to me, is the need to be able to look after myself and not ask permission, not have to work in systems that might not be respectful of that. I want to be in charge of myself because I know what I need most of the time. Yeah, so I know I would make more money probably doing an office job and going to the same place every day, but A, I can't stand that routine, the repetition of it, and B, I just need to be able to know I can move as I want and go where I want, be where I need to be in the right headspace for me. Yeah.
Right, and it's a process, learning that and also having the confidence to make that your life. So if we go back a little bit to talking about university, so you were saying the symptoms were getting worse, but your understanding was beginning to grow.
Mm.
How did things go from there?
Well, things still move quite slowly from there because it can be really helpful to have language for what's going on inside you. So, oh, there's a name for why I feel so low all the time. Or that I have these mood swings. I hated myself so much, I didn't feel worthy of saying, oh, I have a thing, I have depression. I felt like, no, I don't deserve anything, even a word. I'm just bad. I'm a failure. I'm not strong enough to live. So even though I had more awareness, I wasn't really able to fully integrate it, own it, and then ask for help. So it was only after I started seeing someone who was much more knowledgeable of therapy and mental health services, and she was saying, I think you need this. Need to talk to someone because there's too much going on in your head for you to process. It's so overwhelming all the time. You need help. And it's too much for me in our relationship. It can't just be my job. You need outside help. And then after that, I still didn't go for another 2 years, I think, because it's making that shift to move into therapy. It's such a big psychological hurdle to get over. And I really wish I had done earlier because, that was sort of a big turning point for me, is seeking help.
Right, because I think a lot of people have this fear that to get help means admitting you can't do it on your own. And particularly for men, I think that can be correlated with failure, which of course isn't true.
No, absolutely not. But yeah, I had that. You know, I'm the most feminine, to be honest, quite man-hating when I was young, sensitive, overtly emotional person, and yet even I had this sense that I needed to be self-reliant. I couldn't have this weakness, that I just couldn't get through life, my life, without asking for help. Like, that just seemed intolerable to me, that weakness. And it's so funny how I internalized that. I didn't say, well, there's all these unnatural pressures that we have to live under, and work is an odd thing when you look at it, or, you know, we live in this particular society and there's too many people, and, you know, all these things that are givens of our natural / unnatural civilization, the way we have to live and the compromises we have to make with our species essence, if you like. I didn't think, oh, that's just a strange fit and I might need to have some help in particular aspects of that. I thought, I'm a failure. What's wrong with me? I'm the only one who can't just stay alive and be happy. I took it all on myself and I just felt so worthless and crummy about it. And, you know, it's just that simple shift of perspective going, no, it makes sense that I would struggle with these things because, you know, whatever it is, like social anxiety, and I have to meet loads of people on a daily basis, or I don't like crowds and I have to travel on the Northern Line at, you know, 7 in the morning. It's full of people and it's random. Whatever it is, whatever your particular things are, there's reasons that you're going to come up against difficulties in modern society. It's not your fault. That's completely, it'd be weird if you didn't have any. I find it weird when someone says they don't have depression, to be honest. I'm like, why not?
Yeah, I do wonder that. I don't trust people that maybe you've not had a mental illness, but if you've not had a symptom,
yeah.
I'm surprised by that.
Yeah. The mentally well. How well? What's going on with it? What do they think about?
Those people concern me more sometimes.
Yeah, me too.
Interestingly, I think we have this parallel in that for me also, growing up, I kind of realised from a young age I wasn't cut out for the narrow, stereotypical masculinity.
Mm.
As I neither have the inclination or the desire to be like that.
Yeah.
And so it was a process of figuring out, okay, where does my kind of androgynous self fit in this? And so naturally I kind of ended up being the counsel to a lot of my male friends. I was the one they went to talk feelings with because I was good at feelings. I was shit at football. And I wonder to what extent that led me into what I did today. I can certainly relate to having to pick apart the outsiderdom feeling, particularly in your case when you've had it from a race angle and then you're having it from a mental health angle and then work isn't working for you and everyone else seems to be fine with work around you.
Yes.
There's only so much that can stack up before you think, well, can all be wrong. It must be me.
Yeah.
And in that way, depression seems like a very natural reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame myself for reacting. It's like, there's too much. In a way, it's like a way of dampening your feelings, because you're feeling too much. You can't process all that struggle and that sadness. So you sort of shut down and feel a kind of muted sadness, and then sometimes sort of feel nothing. It's sort of worse when you just feel like you're shut off from life and it's just always going to be like this. But just can't sleepwalk your way through it. That's when it's bad. I'm interested in the gender thing, because, like, how do you relate to masculinity now?
Sort of semi-seriously, I guess. I understand it. I understand that it's valuable to some people. I also understand its flaws. And so I kind of interact with that as and when suits. So I know I would describe myself as quite androgynous presenting, and that suits me. And it also means people interpret me in a way that's comfortable for them. So if I meet someone new and, you know, let's say we're doing a podcast and we get chatting to feelings loads, I can find by the end of the interview they're like opening doors for me and doing kind of stereotypically protective things you do towards women. And in many ways that feels more real to me, that gender is more of a spectrum, and I think people are catching up on that now.
Mm.
And so people are welcome to interpret me how they want. I identify as male. But yeah, I don't take it too seriously.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Because I often think, once you get into this territory, you sort of feel like you have to start being really serious about it. And like, all these like rules that you've worked out, and like, this is what I want from people. It's like, I just don't know if I have the strength. Like, I just don't.
It is complicated, but I think in being true to yourself, you can empower a lot of other people.
Mm.
You know, in your writing, you have a raw honesty, particularly about certain topics like mental illness, also the way you talk about sex. A lot of this is very typically male, and yet it's not talked about. And so it's very empowering to hear and to know, oh, it's not just me. That's good to know. Equally, I think that's important to me in trying to dismantle the pressure of masculinity. You know, I've said before on the show that I just think of man up means the same as shut up when it comes to men's feelings.
Yeah.
And that's so dangerous.
Yeah, completely, yeah. Yeah, it's just a silencing and a shaming in my one efficient word package.
And it's extra intense when you're experiencing mental illness, because often that comes with a self-doubt and a wondering, am I ill enough to deserve support? Am I ill enough to take a day off?
You're already on the bottom rung, slipping off, so you're ready to be pushed off the ladder by anyone that wants to do it. Yeah. That's why you're so vulnerable. Yeah.
And so when did you find things started to change for you?
Kind of when I wasn't before my 30s, really. There's a lot of pressure attached to 30 as well as an age.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of an age where it felt to me like, oh, I am me. It's not like finally I put away that thing where I thought, oh, this is just teenage angst, or this is just, I'm a young 20-something, so this is how young people feel. It's like, no, this is who I am. And a lot of these feelings about my personality and how I relate to the world and my angle on it, and my lens, and seeing, looking for the good in those things and realising they're not going away. And I'm not going to have that career path of kind of ambitious people have. In whatever way, I'm not going to do that. Maybe I won't do traditional family thing, because that hasn't happened for me yet, and I still have mixed feelings about that. But kind of just an acceptance that it's okay to be who you are and to grow older is that, and you don't have to change. You have to like yourself, ideally, and be at ease with your world and how you live in it. But yes, letting myself off the hook for other people's expectations and what I imagined where I was meant to be. I've always been so scared of aging, but it comes with a lot of really good things and self-acceptance.
No, that's really powerful. And I think there's a clear distinction there of when you experience depression, it can feel safe and reassuring, almost a sadness. You create a kind of familiarity to it, which seems safe and really isn't, because that's how you go further downhill.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting contrast how there's getting too comfortable in your illness and that being dangerous versus getting comfortable with yourself and who you are.
Yes, that's really an insightful point. Yes, and it's tricky to find that. And I still make mistakes. So sometimes, so I become very accepting of my introversion and the fact that being with lots of people all the time, I like it, I like people, I like being out and talking, but it will exhaust me and I need to go back and spend a lot of time on my own. And that's a healthy realisation. But then where there's this sort of invisible line where at some point you're spending too much time on your own, I haven't really talked to anyone for quite a few days. I don't feel great. Maybe these are related. Maybe I shouldn't be on my own. Maybe I should make more of an effort and force myself to go see friends or socialise. So you've got to be really quite sensitive to yourself and what's good for you, what's a healthy boundary, and what's just giving into your worst impulses, I guess, depression-wise.
Yeah, absolutely, because that's a lot of the danger of it, that you can end up with this kind of third-party perspective. You're almost looking in on life, and then your decisions can feel almost robotic when you're at the worst with depression. That's like you're prescribing yourself time with friends. It's like, who am I to decide that they need to be my solution?
Yeah.
But sometimes you have to force yourself through that and realise what is the depression talking.
That's the hard thing, is I can't always trust myself. It's such an alienating thought. But you have to... That's an important observation, yeah. But then you have to trust yourself to know, I can't trust myself at this point.
Yeah.
It's a very layered, complex sort of gymnastics you have to go through, which is why it's so exhausting. Get better.
It really is. And then you're exhausted, and then the depression starts.
And it gets worse.
Come back to bed. It's warm in here.
That does sound quite nice.
One thing I would like to share is a really insightful line your mum said in the book. Do you mind if I share that?
Please.
And you describe this as your like Simba being taught the way of the world by his father in Lion King moment. And she says, "These things that haunt you, they also let you see. You know that, don't you?" And I really love that, particularly understanding your work as a creative.
Yeah, it was an incredibly generous... Yeah, I remember her saying it to me. It was just such a loving generous, accepting, inspiring and nurturing thing to say. It's that I know you struggle with these things, but you turn them into something, and you know, you don't want to romanticize depression because there's nothing romantic about it, but sort of sensitivities that can lead into creativity and being able to do something with emotion if you can. For me, that's been a real way out. And to acknowledge that they come from the same sort of place, this sort of chaotic base level of kind of primordial feeling, it can have a bad manifestation in your life, but it can also lead to sort of dark beauties and being able to see through things and conventions. And yeah, it gives you a kind of vision on life that other people might not have. And that's an incredibly valuable thing.
I think that's really important for people to hear. You know, it's not romanticizing it, but there are some upsides. Certainly for me, experiencing mental illness has led to so much empathy. And I think I'd struggle with doing this job a lot more without that. And so to me, that's hope. That not only will you get through it, but you'll find some gems along the way. And a lot of people need to hear that, particularly when they're at their worst. So thank you for sharing that. We will wrap up here. So if people want to learn more about you, could you tell them a little bit about your book?
So my book is called I Never Said I Loved You, and it's a memoir about depression and self-harm and childhood abuse and eating disorders, all sorts of fun stuff. But I've tried to make it life and hope and empathy. I've tried to make it a generous and uplifting and funny book, which sounds quite odd and totally jarring, but I really wanted to capture all of life, and a big part of my life has been depression, so there's a lot of darkness and raw feeling in the book. But there's also joy and laughter and confusion and adventure, because that's all been equally part of my life. So I've tried to put it all in the pages, and I'm really proud of it. And I love what you said about empathy. I think that's the biggest upside to all of this, is connecting to people. And that's why I'm terrified of people when people don't have any experiences. I'm like, what do you feel for people who are struggling with something? Because if you don't know what that is, how do you connect to them or really relate to them? And that's actually what binds us as a species. That's why we're still here, is that we can empathize with each other and support each other, because if we don't, then we're screwed.
Yeah, as horrific as emotions can be, they're ultimately what drive us and stop us just being like aimless beings stumbling around the planet.
Yeah, they have an incredible social function, which is to bind us together and help us cooperate.
Yeah, I love that. And the last thing I want to mention is your Twitter, partly because I love your handle being a pun on your last name. So if you want to follow Rick, you need to go to Twitter at What's the Matter.
Please do. I'd love to see you there.
Grand. All right, so we'll finish up there. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.